On this week's episode, my special guest is Roshi Joan Halifax. She's written a brand new book, Standing at the Edge, Finding Freedom Where Fear and Courage Meet. Regarding this book, Arianna Huffington writes, "In Standing at the Edge, Joan Halifax weaves together scientific research with her own powerful personal experiences as a social activist and humanitarian to show how we can transform our biggest challenges with compassion and wisdom. Standing at the Edge is essential reading for our time." Roshi Joan Halifax, PhD, is a Buddhist teacher, Zen priest, anthropologist, and pioneer in the field of end-of-life care. She is founder, abbot, and head teacher at Upaya Institute and Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it's from the institute that she's joining us today. Roshi Joan Halifax, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.
I've read many of your books. I've certainly followed your work in death and dying with my hospice chaplain background. That's near and dear to my heart. I love this book, and I love the title, Standing at the Edge. Can you share how and where you got that idea?
You know, I have been working in this end-of-life care field for many decades, but also working with people who are engaged in human rights, organizations who are also educators and people in politics and people who are in business contexts. And I've had this experience of listening to people who are really endeavoring to serve others, whether it's in the medical system or, as I said, around human rights or education, where there have been certain kinds of sufferings associated with this deep sense of commitment to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And, I learned so much being able to sit in an interview with people and hearing about what their experience is as an educator. For example, taking care of kids in the inner city where there are there's a lot of economic struggle, where parents are absent, where the neighborhoods are dangerous, and the kids are basically traumatized.
Yeah.
Or working in a medical system where there's such high demands, including quotas that have to be met in terms of number of patients one sees. So, I feel very blessed to have also done a lot of work myself,
mm-hmm,
in conditions that have been really challenging in the end-of-life care field, in the prison system, and in human rights work.
Yes,
and
yes.
So, looking at my own experience and the experience of literally thousands of others, I realized that some of the really important qualities that we value in our service to others have a shadow side, and that people can fall into great suffering, whether you're a clinician or a parent or an educator, in terms of, the deep intention to be of service to others, to alleviate suffering, but find oneself in the knot of suffering as well,
mm,
in our experience of serving.
Yes.
And I isolated five of these qualities, and they include altruism. And altruism, a world that has no altruism, is a world that we could not survive in. But also altruism can tip over the edge into what's called pathological altruism, where we are harmed ourselves or harm others in our endeavor to be of service. Empathy, another very important. A world without empathy is where we're dead to each other. But also, if our empathy is not regulated, we can experience empathic distress and secondary trauma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Integrity is essential, but when integrity is not present, moral suffering arises, and that includes moral distress, moral injury, moral outrage, and moral apathy. Respect is essential. That's another edge state that I've isolated. And, of course, the opposite is disrespect. The shadow side is disrespect, where you have horizontal hostility and vertical violence. And then, finally, engagement, that, we're wholeheartedly involved in our actions of compassion toward others, but we have to also be mindful of burnout.
Yeah, Yeah. I love the subtitle of this book, Finding Freedom, Where Fear and Courage Meet. It seems so appropriate today. In all of your travels, I believe it wasn't that long ago you were in Hawaii with Ram Dass and Frank Ostateski, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
But you travel the world. Have you seen in the last couple of years an increase in stress, an increase in fear wherever you go?
Well, one of the things that I said is that, you know, in a way, the meme of terror that got really activated around 9/11 now is instantiated, not just nationally, but also globally. And also how our attention has been co-opted by the corporate world through our digital devices. And that is putting a tremendous stress on us because our attention is constantly being attracted by these wonderful technologies that have been developed, but where we've actually disinhabited our world of relationship, direct relationship. And so I think there are many factors, economic, political, environmental, that compose a system of complexity that's giving rise to, you know, more and more stress, including the degradation of our environment. And there are more and more needs that have to be met because people are experiencing psychological and physical states that are a result of the intertwining of economic, environmental, social, cultural features that are part of our life today, including this, you know, unbearable demand of a huge population that is streaming out of areas of conflict and also areas affected by climate change.
Early in the book, you
share. So we have a lot of work to do, but we also have to create the conditions where we're not only resilient, but where we have the means to actually flourish in this work of addressing suffering.
Early in the book, you share an idea called positive disintegration. I'm wondering if you could share, first of all, what that means, and also, why is that so important?
So the notion of positive disintegration, which, by the way, is not just in terms of 20th century psychology, where Dabrowski and others, Julian Silverman, my ex-husband Stanislav Grof, and, you know, myself and others, where we saw the value of entropy falling apart. But, you know, that is a vision that is carried by indigenous cultures in rites of passage or by the role of the shaman in a culture who goes through a psychomental crisis. And what we know from psychology is that stress can be distress or it can be eustress. In other words, distress is where there's entropy that leads to complete dissolution, or eustress is stress that actually enhances our well-being. And rites of passage are contexts where stress happens that is actually eustress, or even falling over the edge, as I describe in my book. One builds character by actually making one's way out of the abyss up that steep cliff to the high edge of virtue, where you're able to see the whole landscape, not just the positive part of the landscape. So in terms of the development of one's character, we don't have to look for problems. Problems will be given to us throughout our lifespan. The Buddha had it right up until the day he died, in terms of Mara, the devil, if you will, showing up, which is really a way to talk about the devilment of our own mind. And, you know, it is really important for us to understand that catastrophe has within it the great possibility of our opportunity. And that's one of the premises in this book.
It's not
just a description of the shadow side, but it's also the acknowledgement that, you know, we all go over the edge. And we have this just really important opportunity that we can actualize in working with compassion to transform these great difficulties into benefits, not just burdens.
Speaking of shadow, you shared just a few minutes ago an overview of the edge states that you lay out in this book, the first one being altruism, and you acknowledge the profound strengths associated with that. Most of my listeners would say, well, yeah, there's nothing wrong with altruism, and yet you write it also has a shadow.
Absolutely. Altruism has a big shadow, and it's been Barbara Oakley and others have talked about it in terms of pathological altruism, and that's when, you know, we harm ourselves by, you know, in the course of serving others. For example, you know, we burn out. We become emotionally upregulated and experience emotional distress and empathic or personal distress that we actually sometimes harm the people we're trying to serve because we disempower them through how we're serving.
Mm-hmm.
We infantilize them. We make them dependent on us. Or the institutions, like a whole nation, could be disempowered through service. Or, you know, the UN goes into Haiti or the Red Cross, and gosh, what happens? You've got cholera on one side and, you know, no visible housing construction on another. So the faith in institutions of service gets actually broken. So pathological altruism has many different expressions.
Yeah, I've seen that. Having made numerous trips to Haiti, I've seen that played out all too often in the country of Haiti. And, you know, it's frustrating to be able to witness that. What about empathy, though? In the book, you make a point of distinguishing between empathy and compassion. And that's a nice distinction to make.
Right. So empathy is when we're in resonance with another. And, you know, that could be with our patient, our parent. It could be with our pet. It could be with a whole nation, for example. And is that where we're in this kind of either physical resonance, or it could include emotional resonance, or it could include cognitive resonance, where in terms of perspective taking, you know, where we can see how people presumably see the world. And that kind of identification process, which is based on resonance, direct experience, is really important. Although we can't validate what we are experiencing in terms of what another experiences is actually true. But when one is over-identified and doesn't make a distinction between self and other, then personal distress can arise. And this is called, you know, empathic arousal,
yes.
Empathic over-arousal, and empathic distress. And people really suffer. You know, I have so many clinicians who come into my world who found themselves over-identifying with their patients to the point where they become disabled, unable to really serve.
Yeah.
So learning how to actually regulate empathy, but empathy is essential. But at the same time, compassion, if you're empathic, doesn't necessarily mean you want to end the suffering. You're simply in resonance with it. Some psychologists conflate compassion and empathy, but a whole other group of social psychologists make a clear distinction. And compassion involves a number of factors, you know, including the deep concern for the well-being of another or others and the intention to do something that will actually alleviate that suffering.
You've shared that a good example of cognitive empathy or perspective taking or mind reading gone awry is the Third Reich, where people identified with Hitler.
Exactly. And every cult in the world has this problem. That's why they're cults. It's when we actually lose our moral compass because we are in such resonance with a charismatic leader that we lose our moral grounding, our moral compass. Third Reich is a good example, but, you know, any religious cult is an example of this as well.
So integrity is one of the edge states you've identified. What could be the downside or shadow side to integrity?
Well, I put all this under the rubric of moral suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of suffering that arises when we directly incur, produce, or witness the unconscionable acts of others or ourselves. So moral distress is the first category I talk about, and this is when we see a way through a situation where there's suffering, but we actually can't implement it. We don't see that the solution is going to be viabilized. And that's something that actually a lot of people in medicine, but also education, come up against, the sense of moral distress.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then the next category, Richard, that I talk about is moral injury, and that is when we have participated directly or witnessed directly acts that that trespass our moral principles. So, for example, moral injury is rampant in the military, and so many of the vets who leave the military are actually suffering from moral injury. This is where they have a deep sense of shame and also self-blame in relation to the actions that they've engaged in that has caused or have caused suffering to others or the environment.
Well, and what about the role of moral outrage in our society?
Moral outrage is in a way the mirror of a moral injury. It's when shaming and blaming is outwardly directed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an admixture of anger and disgust. And the disgust thing is really important because our threat to our integrity, to our survival, is very deep in our brain system.
Yeah.
And so moral outrage and polarization is also rampant. You see it in the political world that our politicians, in terms of social media, are using moral outrage in a certain way to viralize or breed moral outrage in others and polarize our nation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yet also moral outrage probably is an example borne out in the last couple of years with the Me Too movement.
Well, and it's important. I mean, His Holiness the Dalai Lama said recently at a small conference that, you know, and I agree with this, having episodic moral outrage, that is more, or reactive moral outrage, that is, you know, having the sense of our integrity or the world's well-being violated, and the sense of moral outrage instigates then actions that are wholesome in terms of ending that violation.
Yes.
So, you know, just like, you know, moral injury can be of benefit to an experiencer, in other words, feeling shame and then taking responsibility for causing harm to others.
When I think of the energy involved in moral outrage, I would think also that even that could be addictive.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there are friends of mine who are absolutely carried away by and feel wonderful in, you know, just thrashing everyone inside. So, you know, again, it's to recognize, oh, I have a tendency to toward moral outrage. It feels really good. I love to have righteous anger driving my actions. And actually, righteous anger for just a flash can be useful.
Sure.
But as a chronic state, it's harmful.
Yes. Angry activists get burned out eventually, it seems.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a terrible state of mind to be in.
Yes, yes. Another edge state is respect.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, actually, the last one is important in this group of four,
yeah.
Richard, that
yes.
I just don't want to leave out, and that's moral apathy.
Oh, please.
And moral apathy is very important for us to look at because, you know, the privilege that so many of Western people enjoy, but not everyone, makes us, in a way, we're living in a bubble of privilege, and we don't actually see the suffering of others or how addiction plays. So privilege and addiction, two different things, but sometimes interconnected. How addiction covers up our sense, whether it's addiction to substances or lifestyle or sex or to the internet, it actually is putting a kind of anesthesia over our perception of suffering. So, you know, moral apathy can be blind to us, can be engendered by the social context in which we find ourselves, like, you know, we just took it for granted, you know, 50 years ago that women would be hit on in the workplace.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We just took it for granted that people of color would be discriminated against. Well, sorry, it's still going on, but we're much more aware of white privilege and how white privilege operates in our lives to create implicit racism.
We then come
to... have to bump ourselves out of our bubble, so to speak.
I love that phrase. Yeah, we do, don't we? And we can still become complacent. I know Richard Rohr has talked about that a lot. That's been his concern, especially in the United States. We kind of numb ourselves with TV and trivial topics all the time.
Exactly. I mean, well, you know, our use of our digital devices is a great way. We, you know, put our attention to something outward that is stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So another edge state that you write about in your book is respect. And, you know, it's kind of hard to see a downside to respect, at least at first.
Well, we could say, but the shadow side, of course, of respect is disrespect. And this comes in, you know, in relation to power. For example, 15 to 20% of nurses leave nursing because of bullying, being disrespected by their colleagues, by their peers. And we saw the same thing in the feminist movement in the 70s, that, you know, there was a lot of abrupt, abrasive, and unkind behavior between peers in the early feminist movement in this country. You see it also, so horizontal hostility happens, you know, in the religious context. You can see it between educators and so forth. Then there's vertical violence, and that is top-down or bottom-up. That is where, you know, someone who has more power or perceived power than, say, an employee, it's a boss-employee situation, or doctor-patient, or doctor-nurse, where there are imbalances of power and where there's disrespect manifested in terms of how power is expressed. Also, bottom-up vertical violence, where we see people who are disenfranchised attacking those in power, or you see students attacking their teachers, or you see kids attacking their parents. So there's bottom-up vertical violence as well.
Wow.
Which is, you know, really the kind of norms of civility that you know, our society has treasured are right now, you know, pretty challenged.
Yeah.
But I think that we don't recognize mostly, for example, just in relation to race or gender or age, those people who have less power or purchase in our social communities have been subjected to vertical violence, top-down vertical violence from forever. You know, that's why we have to go back to, you know, really be a values-driven society and to make sure these values are based in a vision of, that is civil and kind.
Yeah.
And on, you know, in a vision that's really about not harming.
Absolutely. In your book, Standing at the Edge, the fifth edge state is engagement, which can be another slippery slope for many of us.
It's true, because, you know, I was a little late for our meeting, only because, you know, we're in a wonderful process with our whole organization and of really restructuring the leadership here and how our place operates. It's really, really exciting what's going on. And, you know, I said, well, I'm the kind of person who's all in. You know, it's kind of 24/7. But I've learned to pace myself. You know, I understand the value of naps. I understand the value of walking on the beach. I understand how important it is to be off social media for a month at a time, like when I'm in the Himalayas. That, you know, I have a healthy relationship with my work process. I feel enthusiasm for work, that it's meaningful work, and that the workplace itself is non-toxic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if it's toxic, or the demands of work are something that cannot be met, or the task itself is meaningless or promoting harm in the world, then burnout is the outcome.
Yes, burnout is rampant these days because I think people aren't taking care of themselves. And actually, you've kind of answered another question I had, and that is, how do you live with the edge states? And do you find yourself ever overwhelmed with all the traveling and all the situations you find yourself in? Like you said, death and dying, prison work. It can be trying. I've seen a lot of good people do harm to themselves.
Well, I think one thing is that, you know, I've had a practice for 50 years, and that's benefiting me more and more, if you know what I'm saying. It's like I suffered from all of these edge states, which is probably why I wrote about them, because they were not only the experience of others, they were also my experience. But I learned the value of self-care and of regulating my situation so I could maintain some kind of strength and also sensitivity. So I, you know, the metaphor of strong back, soft front, and is something I use in the book, and I use with my students all the time. That that learning when you're about to go over the edge, to pull yourself back, and to regulate, and to have the exhale, and to not have such disregard for your own situation that you don't. You know, I'll say, and I'm glad I'm so old, I can say it pretty legitimately now. Okay, I have to rest now. I won't be going to that funder's dinner. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Uh-huh. Yeah, well, with age,
and
hopefully...
I'm not afraid to have, you know, clear agreements and strong boundaries.
Yes.
Because I know I can only do so much.
Well, and we need those, don't we? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Will you share a little bit? You're the founder, abbot, and head teacher of the Paya Institute and Zen Center there in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Share a little bit about what's going on there for our listeners.
It's an incredible place. It's a beautiful place physically, but it's a place that integrates social action and contemplation. Mm-hmm. So there's a very strong emphasis on a daily practice. There's also a very strong emphasis on training people who are chaplains and clinicians and people in human rights organizations and having the tools to really sustain themselves and to flourish in what they're doing in their service to others. So we're, you know, one of those places that values social engagement. And that social engagement happens in terms of direct process with others, service to others. So, you know, like some of our Sangha members sit with dying people in the cancer center here or in the hospital or in, you know, homes. We have a group that's been meeting since 1994 of people who are suffering from grief but also going through loss themselves.
Yes.
We have a street ministry where our community cooks for homeless people every week or so. We have a prison project, which is nice. We also work in the Himalayas with healthcare providers at high altitude in these very remote areas where there's no access to healthcare. We provide all kinds of support for Rohingya refugees in Kathmandu. So we're, you know, it's a real integration of UPAYA integrates study, practice, livelihood, social service, and community.
Mm.
It's a real mandala of life that we hope that, you know, has downstream effects. Now we have, you know, many chaplains and institutions all over the world who are bringing the sense of ethics and a Buddhist view and also practice into their role as chaplains. And the same with clinicians.
And what is the website for people to get more information?
Wonderful. It's www.upaya.org.
Yeah, yeah. And let me ask you this. Given the body of work that you've done, the traveling you've done, and the depth I believe you go in many of the other books I've read from you, I'd like to know, I find that as I get older, hopefully I'm learning more. I'm gaining a little more wisdom, even from the mistakes I've made. What is Roshi Joan Halifax learning, and what have you learned about love?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. Well, one of the things I've learned is to love all equally. That it's just a sense of deep care that is not reserved just for your family or your community. But, you know, when I'm in an airport and feeling, you know, actually practicing that as an act of practice with people who are total strangers who are hurrying by. So one is to really love all beings equally. Another has to do with understanding how the profound benefits of compassion, the profound benefits of serving others. And that so much of my work as an educator and also practitioner has been to understand what compassion is and how you can teach it in the world, but also you have to live it to the extent it's possible for you at any given moment. And the third thing for me that I think is really very, very visible personally is having been a contemplative practitioner for more than five decades now, it's 55 years, of having the wonderful opportunity to see the fruits of practice become more visible as I've become an elder. You know, I mean, I wanted a quick fix 30 years ago, right? But I didn't realize that, you know, I'd be in my mid-late 70s, and wow, all that stuff I was doing, all those sessions years ago, I see the benefit now.
Yes. You're not slowing down, are you?
Well, I think that, you know, it's not a matter in you know, of velocity. it's a matter of depth. And I feel, you know, my life is deeper and more real, and there, I feel very grateful to be alive while there's so many problems, because I feel, you know, a thing or two I've learned might be useful, might be useful to others.
Well said. The book is Standing at the Edge, Finding Freedom, Where Fear and Courage Meet. Roshi Joan Halifax, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, and thank you for the gift of this book.
Thank you so much for, you know, interacting with me, and I've loved making this connection with you.
Finishing the teachings of Joan Halifax have been such a blessing to me over the years. Again, this book is Standing on the Edge, Finding Freedom, Fear and Courage Meet. You can visit her online at upaya.org. That's upaya.org. And I want to thank you for joining me today as well. And for engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire, where bringing love to life, one podcast at a time.
Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Well, for my guest today, from writing hits for other artists to recording her own, twice Grammy-nominated Beth Nielsen Chapman, Nashville-based singer-songwriter has truly embraced musical diversity. A breast cancer survivor, environmental activist, teacher of workshops, and lecturer on the magic of creativity, she's penned numerous hits and written songs for many top artists, including Bonnie Raitt, Emmylou Harris, Bette Midler, Elton John, Neil Diamond, Trisha Yearwood, Michael McDonald, Amy Grant, Keb Moe, Roberta Flack, Faith Hill, Willie Nelson, and so many other artists. Her music has been heard on TV shows ER, Dawson's Creek, Providence, Felicity, and in movie soundtracks including The Prince of Egypt, Message in a Bottle, The Rookie, Where the Heart Is, and Practical Magic. Mega hit This Kiss, sung by Faith Hill, was ASCAP's 1999 Song of the Year, garnered a Grammy nomination, and Nashville NAMI's 1999 Songwriter of the Year. Among Beth's own recordings, the groundbreaking song Sand and Water, released following the death of her husband from cancer in 1994, was performed by Elton John on his 1997 U.S. tour in place of Candle in the Wind. It's a joy to have Beth on the program because I've been such a fan of her music, and she joins us from her home in beautiful Nashville, Tennessee. Beth Nielsen Chapman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be talking to you, Richard.
It is such a joy to have you on. I have followed your music, and you know, then I realized that so many of the artists whose songs I so enjoyed were songs you wrote.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that, that you got to hear them.
There's a lot that I want to talk about, but first let's start kind of in the beginning for you. I believe you were 10 or 11. I think your dad, who's in the military, correct?
Yep, he's in the Air Force.
Yeah, and I believe it was in Germany when the story I read is your mom hit a guitar for Father's Day. You found it and started playing guitar, and I think it was that year where you started learning how to play guitar and piano.
It really, you know, we always had a little piano rented somewhere, you know, along the way as I was growing up, but I got really interested about the time I stole the guitar from my dad before Father's Day. I kind of showed it to him. I let him view it for a few seconds and said, oh, this will be in my room whenever you want to play it. So, but the timing couldn't have been better because I was just at that angsty age of 10, 11, you know, starting to turn into a teenager and all of the hormones going crazy. And it was 1968, and that was really an age for me where I was kind of starting to watch the news and look at, you know, kind of look around out of my child, peek out of my childhood into the world. And I was stunned by the scariness of some stuff, you know, like I'd be watching the news on the Vietnam War and things. And we were stationed in Germany at the time. And really what dovetailed around that same time was that we went to one of the field trips that we had at our school, unbelievably, was to go to Dachau, and which is a concentration camp. And, I mean, I think a child of 11 or 12 just should not go there as a field trip. Honestly, I thought it was not a good idea.
It was very intense.
It was very intense, and it kind of shocked me. It was like, I don't know, weeks and weeks following that, I had really bad nightmares. And in the interim, my father got his orders, and we were to move and be restationed, which happened every couple of years. But at this particular time, and when I was feeling that vulnerable and overwhelmed, we got our orders to move to Montgomery, Alabama. And that was just terrifying to me because I was also up on the fact that, you know, they just shot Martin Luther King and all this other stuff, and the civil rights movement. And my mom was like, honey, you know, you need to chill out. I'm like, you know. But it's amazing. The guitar and writing songs and writing poetry and, you know, hiding myself under the covers and being creative really saved me through that period of time and gave me a lifelong connection to creativity being the tool that helps me to heal and helps me through my life. And to this day, you know, it's been and continues to be that way.
Well, it has, and I want to talk about a few things like that here coming up. I'm only 2 years older than you, and so I remember what you're talking about. I remember the news where they had the casualties listed. I remember when I was a little boy hearing that Robert F. Kennedy got assassinated, and I had tears down my face. I'm also wondering concerning music, because of our similar age, were you also, as I was, although I'm not a singer-songwriter, and my escape was nature, that's why I'm an environmentalist, were you influenced by James Taylor and Carole King and some of those people back then who were writing so many cool songs at that time?
Oh, yes. Oh, massively. I mean, you know, right around the time that we moved to Nashville, I mean, within a year, James Taylor was all over the airwaves.
Yeah.
And prior to that, I'd always been completely magnetically, you know, pulled towards songs, like songs that my parents' Tony Bennett albums and all the classic, you know, songs of the 30s and the 40s, and I was just always enamored with structure and the way a song pops and what about a song just like reaches into the heart of people. I mean, I remember noticing that really, really young age, and then when James Taylor and Joni Mitchell and Carole King and all those guys came along, they were like my people. You know, that was like my real stepping into, this is my music, and and that had a huge influence on me, of course, and so many other people. And even, you know, even that I was still listening to jazz and Motown and R&B and all that all at the same time. We just got to grow up at a time when there was such a melting pot of creative influences that we were exposed to, you know. And nowadays you have to go to the channel that has this and go to the channel that has that. And it's easy to miss, I think, so much richness that, you know, that we were... You and I, you know, in the age that we grew up in, it was just all right there.
Yeah, yeah. And you were the middle child of five. Did your siblings also have a passion for music, or were you primarily the
one? Well, yeah, we all loved it. I mean, you know, we'd fight over who got to play the Beatles records and the Monkees records. I'm the only surviving professional musician that I know of, but my three sisters and my brother are all very, very creative. And, you know, one of the great gifts that we got from our parents was kind of a blank check to be creative. And, you know, when I announced that I wanted to be a songwriter, nobody went, oh, wait a minute, you got to get a real job, you know.
Yeah.
I was encouraged, you know, to go make up stuff, you know. And my sister's a clothing designer in San Francisco, and my brother and his wife, Billy, make Billy Bees, which are these tremendously cool, you know, pieces of art that you wear.
Yeah,
you know, so there's just a lot of... you know, and I took it for granted for many years, and now that I teach a lot of workshops and I do a lot of teaching to people, not just songwriters, but people of all different walks of life, and one of the things that I'm so passionate about is I'm really good at helping people find out that they, too, have access to this creative flow. I mean, you're born, it's a birthright.
Yeah.
It's so easily stamped out of us at a young age by well-meaning rule-making adults, or sometimes ridiculed by our peers, that you have to resurrect your own pilot light and the ability to relight it. And
Absolutely.
It goes out, and you got to relight it, you know. You got to get back into that connection with our creative gift that we're all given.
Oh, I know. It's about inspiring that fire inside, isn't it?
It is, and also remembering that even if you're feeling really depleted, that it's just like eating lunch, you know, that wears off, and then it's time to cook something else and eat dinner, you know. So you have to understand it's cultivation of a relationship. It's not just, oh, she's so talented and she's so creative and she just does all this stuff and it just happens so easily for her.
Exactly.
It's never like that. It's a cultivation, and the skill of staying connected to your inner creative genius is a real accessible opportunity that everybody has.
When did you know? When was there a pivotal moment for you, Beth, when you realized and you were starting to write music, play music, that, wow, I could actually make a living doing this?
Well, you know, it was back in that day, I could.
Expenses were low.
I came of age at a time when people that were talented songwriters got publishing deals. That's very much changed, and that's a whole other conversation. But I do remember being amazed that I could go and, you know, like somebody called me up and they'd heard me singing in church or something, or some school thing, and they said, would you sing at my wedding? Yeah. And I remember being like 16 or so and going, oh, sure, thinking, wow, that's really going to be fun. And then they paid me, and I was blown away. I didn't even think I was going to, I didn't even think about it getting paid. And then pretty soon I was just doing five weddings a week, you know, and I started to, you know, so much of the stuff that happened to me early on just sort of happened very naturally and unfolded without me trying. So I got this sort of false sense of, oh, this is easy, you know, and I sort of stumbled into making my first record in Muscle Shoals with Barry Zeckett producing and all the great Muscle Shoals guys. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and looking back on it, I can see, well, the reason that they were interested is because I showed talent and I had, you know, some songs that showed that I was maybe someone that could do this. But at the time, I thought I was just getting away with murder. You know, I thought, well, any minute they're going to find out that I don't know what I'm doing. But, hey, as long as it's working. But then there was also this kind of overlay within me of almost a sense of entitlement. Like, well, of course, everything I do is great because my mom said so, you know. And I'd never had anybody actually challenge me to be better, or to, hey, you know, you should really rewrite that song and make it better. And so when my first album came out on Capitol Records in 1979, mm-hmm. the universe planned it perfectly. You know, as it rolled out, and I was completely convinced that the next thing was I'd have a big hit, and then I'd be touring, and then I'd have to get a manager, and everything would be perfect. And then nothing happened. It was like it came out, and I got some reviews that said things like, too bad she didn't put this out 5 years ago, because this is really quite nice, you know, like Carole King. Only what was happening is that Disco Duck was all over the airwaves, and Donna Summer, and suddenly everything went disco. And singer-songwriter-sensitive music kind of went bye-bye for a while, right as I came out the gate. So, you know, I went and licked my wounds for 3 or 4 years and just went back home. I had a baby and decided I'm not really a singer-songwriter. I must not have what it takes, which is such a bad conclusion.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I shut myself down. And, you know, when I'm teaching songwriters that are, or people that are trying to recreate how to be creative, I'm like, I know exactly where you're at. You're in this abyss of not believing in yourself, and I know that feeling, and it's just that you just have to start doing it again, and it regrows. Mm-hmm. It really does. Mm-hmm. It comes back, and you know, but it just took me a couple of years, but I'd say, you know, some of the biggest developments for me as a songwriter were the years that I didn't write.
Yeah.
Because during that time, I was busy just being in my life and getting experiences so that when I did go back to writing, I had a little bit more depth about what I had to say.
Yeah. You shared something earlier, and I think it is tragic, and I agree with you. One of the things that has kept me drawn to your music is I think you're a master storyteller. I remember having a similar conversation with a friend of this radio show and a fellow Hoosier, a Carrie newcomer, who I see as a gifted storyteller. And it does seem like, I'm hoping that makes a resurgence now, because I'd hate to think we're living in a Bieber world. with so much superficiality, and the lyrics don't count, because back in the day, like we talked about, James Taylor, Carole King, Beth Nielsen Chapman, it's the lyrics that are powerful, and that's what I have so appreciated about your work. I want to skip ahead a little bit, because I want to go to one of the songs that I want to play, and I just love this song, and there is a powerful story behind this. And that was when your first husband, Ernest, died of cancer. I believe it was in 1994.
Yes, that's right.
As an interfaith minister, part of my past was working with hospice, and so I was always with a lot of people who went through those dark shadows of the soul, if you will. And first of all, what was that like for you? And I believe one of the things that helped you deal with your grief was your songwriting, and then you wrote the song Sand and Water.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the moment, you know, that I started playing that guitar to survive through the late 60s onward, it was a refuge for me. With the exception of the few years after my record came out, I put the guitar in the closet and I decided to turn my back on it because it was like it wasn't working. But when I did pull that back into my life, obviously, anytime I have given it a chance, that creative flow has definitely shown up. And going through the loss of my husband was the most incredible, difficult thing I could have ever imagined. And I remember writing half of the songs that ended up on the Sand and Water album. I had started about a year and a half before he was diagnosed. And I didn't even know what I was writing them about. There's a song on that album called Seven Shades of Blue, which I remember playing it for him way before we knew we had cancer on the horizon. And he loved that song, and he would say, you got to finish that song, you got to finish it. It's like your Bob Dylan song, it's my favorite thing you've ever done. What's it about? I'm like, I don't know. But, you know, that's happened to me many times in my life where I've started writing things before the actual events happened.
Mm-hmm.
And even writing Sand and Water, which I wrote about a month after Ernest died, I sat down and it came through very quickly, but it was like the melody came through, and then the sound of the words came through. Like I was writing down nonsense syllables, but the vowels were there.
Yeah,
that matched up with the final lines.
Yeah.
So it was almost as if that song was rising up through the sand, and I couldn't quite make it out, but I was just following the shape of it.
Mm.
And I write a lot of songs that way, from a very sort of intuitive place. And you know, intuition is one of the things that's kind of scary to people because we want to, you know, our brains want to name everything and they want to know everything and get everything organized and figure out where it belongs. And creativity is the antithesis of that. And I know that you have to be a good editor and a good analyzer, and you have to be able to get the nuts and bolts and the craft of writing really, you know, well established in order to be a very accomplished songwriter. But if you don't have the front end of that, which is this sort of mushy, I don't even know what, I don't know what's happening. You know, I don't know, something's coming through me. If you can get comfortable not knowing what you're doing, if you can get comfortable in the space of like it hasn't happened yet, but it could happen any second, but you're waiting for it. That's what I work with people on the most, because God knows they've been given enough rules and they've read all the books and they know all the ways to make the song better. But if you don't have the beginning of something that's strong enough that comes from that place of the our deep emotional experience, then, you know, Nashville, if you'll pardon the expression, the way that they put that in Nashville is you can spend a lot of time polishing a turd, but a turd is still a turd. You know, it's like you can polish it, you can have it very well organized, but if you're not reaching somebody's heart.
Yeah.
So that process of being grief-stricken, unbeknownst to me, you know, now looking back, of course, I can talk about it very clearly, but in the moment that I was writing that song, I was in a moment of chaos and sort of surrendered sorrow of such a deep level that I just didn't even think I was doing anything. I remember writing it down and going, well, this doesn't make any sense. And the first person I played it for was Rodney Crowell, who was coming over to my house. And he was like, I said, Mom, I'll play the song. Maybe you can help me fix it. And I played him Sand and Water as it completely is right now. And he was like, wow. And I said, yeah, I know, it's not great. He goes, no, it's really good. And I'm like, no. He goes, no, it's really, hey, let me tell you something. He goes, you are a grieving widow woman, and you don't know what you just wrote. And he goes, please don't touch that and leave it alone, and it'll take care of itself. It'll go out in the world, and 20 years from now, you're still going to be hearing back from people that found that song when they needed to hear it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened with it. And so when I do a little seminar and I'm playing my hits and whatever, I'll play my This Kiss hit, you know, and then I'll play Sand and Water and say, now this is another kind of a hit. And frankly, it's like a soul hit, you know. It's one of those songs that as a songwriter, I feel so thankful that anything I wrote out of all that pain has gone forward without me even ever anticipating that.
Yeah.
And has been helpful to other people.
Yeah, it's a very heartfelt song. It was also good enough for Elton John to perform it during his 97 world tour. One of the lyrics that really struck me, and I couldn't help but think of a few families I had worked with in the past. All alone I heal this heart of sorrow. All alone I raise this child. Flesh and bone, he's just bursting towards tomorrow. And his laughter fills my world. And where's your smile? You were speaking of your husband who had passed away. I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life with singer-songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman. We're going to go to that song right now, and after, we'll have more of the conversation. Here's Sand and Water.
Just sand and water, baby. million years gone by. I will see you in the light of a thousand suns. I will hear you in the sound of the waves. I will know you when I come, as we all will come through the doors beyond. My world and where's your smile? I will see you in the light of a thousand suns. I will hear you in the sound of the waves. I will doors beyond the grave. All alone I came into this world. All alone I will someday die. Solid stone.
Welcome back to the program. It is a joy to have Beth Nielsen-Chapman joining us today. We're talking about, oh, her music, her life. There's other topics I want to get to here shortly. Beth, one of the things that struck me about you, and I didn't really realize how often songs are used this way until Joshua Radin has been on the program a couple of times, because so many of his songs are actually in TV shows and movies. Well, yours are as well. And as a matter of fact, this song that we had just played, Sand and Water, I believe it was in one of the seasons of ER, which I used to watch all the time, and a TV show, Charmed. And and a lot of your songs have been in those kind of venues. Well, what a treat today on this one program. We've had Joan Halifax, what a great spiritual teacher, and singer-songwriter Beth Nielsen-Chapman. I want to thank you for joining me here on 887 FM WICR. A reminder that all shows are podcast on my site, richardbrendan.com. And so for engineer Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.